The quest to reach the North Pole had long animated the imaginations of many an explorer. The first person to achieve that is still a matter of debate, actually. Dr. Frederick A. Cook claimed to have arrived there by an overland expedition in April of 1908. American explorer Robert E. Perry, Matthew Henson, and four indigenous guides claimed to be the first to arrive in April 1909. Both parties' records, though, are subject to suspicion, odd journal keeping. The first verifiable record at the North Pole came when an airship from the Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen and his U.S. sponsor, Lincoln Ellsworth, arrived there in May 1926. That's less than 100 years ago. But in the decades and centuries before these first arrivals, most people believed that the North Pole was actually an open sea. The first explorers to attempt runs at the North Pole thought that in certain seasons, the ice might open, and passageways through the ice floes could take you to the open sea at the top of the world, the North Pole. George DeLong was an explorer backed by the wealthy and very eccentric owner of the New York Herald, James Gordon Bennett II. DeLong set sail from San Francisco in 1879 with a crew of 31. He was heralded by crowds and media frenzy. Could a U.S. citizen and crew be the first to arrive at the North Pole? And so they cruised under the Golden Gate Bridge. DeLong's daring voyage christened by the sound of a 21-gun cannon salute. They were off to take their place with the storied legacies of other explorers. And once in the open sea, DeLong pressed north. He sailed cautiously just below the borders of the Arctic ice pack. After having scoured the horizon of ice for days, finally a voice bellowed out from the crow's nest, "There! There's a channel that leads to open water." DeLong realized this was his moment. Could this be it? His opportunity to head into the fabled open waters that would take him to the North Pole. If this was indeed the open water passage to the north, DeLong's name, his ship, his crew would be the talk of the world. They would undoubtedly be the last great names in exploration. And so the crew boldly steered their ship into the channel, but they realized their error in under an hour. Now they could only see ice in every direction, and their options were starting to dwindle. Lured into the ice pack by the promise of glory, they struggled onward as the ice was closing in around them from every direction, and they tried to maneuver the ship this way and that, but it was of no use. And on Sunday, September 7th, 1879, a large floe of ice shoved their ship, the Jeannette, onto an ice shelf. Other bergs quickly tightened in around her. It had only taken minutes, but the Jeannette was now imprisoned. Her steam engine panted and spat out thick plumes of smoke as she desperately tried to free herself, but the ship would not budge an inch. The ice had her in its teeth, and it would not let go. Now, this turn of events was not entirely unexpected. DeLong and his crew had known that wintering in the ice pack was a genuine possibility. In fact, they had planned for it. Should their ship become stuck in the claws of the ice, they would simply hunker down for a few months before the spring thaw released them, hopefully into the open seas further north. Even still, the harsh reality of their situation left them in a constant state of anxiety. And George DeLong, the captain, took to his journal and remarked this: "We live in a weary suspense. Wintering in the pack may be a thrilling thing to read about, but the actual thing is sufficient to make any man prematurely old. A crisis may occur at any moment, and we can do nothing but be thankful it has not occurred yet." As their anxious wait in the ice began, the days grew shorter and colder until on November 16th, 1879, all natural light disappeared altogether. For the next 71 days, the Jeannette and her crew would be cloaked in darkness as they endured the winter and the ice floe. And the hope of the spring thaw was all that kept them through many a day. Still, their situation would become irreconcilably bleaker than they ever could have imagined. The grip of the ice would not hold them for a few long months. No, for 2 years, the Jeannette remained tight in its grip. 2 years. 2 years of the sun coming and then disappearing for months at a time. 2 years of the same daily routine. 2 years of the same lousy diet, canned pemmican and concentrated lime juice. 2 years hoping, please let a polar bear pass by so we can turn it into a meal. 2 years. Within these two torturous years, DeLong and his men, they came to understand the truth of the matter. There was no open sea further north. The north was simply a barren landscape of ice and snow. Their life's work and dream was meaningless. 2 years for nothing. Would their ship ever be free? Around midnight on June 11th, 1881, something incredible happened, though. While most of the crew slept, the ice opened with a ragged crack, and the Jeannette slipped into the water. After 2 years, the ship was floating. It was a remarkable sensation for DeLong and his crew. Finally, the ice had released them from her grip, and the promise of a journey home to friends and family, it hung teasingly in front of them. And the crew gave up a great cheer, but their good fortune was short-lived, as nature seemed to toy with them like a cat and a mouse. Just hours later, the floes began to close in around them again, but this time it was different. The ice delivered a terrific grinding, the pressure tightening with tremendous force. The sounds were horrendous, as though the Jeannette was being tortured and maimed. Minute by minute, the pressure intensified until a great fist of ice punctured the hull of the ship, piercing its vitals. Water and ice rushed into the hull of the ship. Finally, the words that they'd been dreading for 2 long years finally came. "Abandon ship!" cried DeLong. "Abandon ship!" The crew raced to get as many provisions as they could off the ship before the ice had its way with her. DeLong's logs and journals and official papers for the Jeannette, they were wrapped in canvas and handed off the ship. Everywhere was the sound of ripping bolts, groaning lumber, yawning metal. The boat was in her death throes. There was no more time. The men cleared the decks until it was just DeLong left on board, and he seemed to linger, as though he wanted a few minutes alone with his dying ship. And as water rushed into her crippling frame, DeLong waved his cap as if in salute and said, "Goodbye, old ship." Then he jumped to the ice floe and watched with his crew as the ice devoured her. With the Jeannette gone, the men took stock of their situation. 60 days worth of food and provisions. Might gain a few more days if they ate their dogs, but that was the end of it. Beyond the limited stores of food, they also faced the limits of time. There were only so many days left in the Arctic summer. Captain DeLong understood very well what needed to happen. They would have to reach Siberia before winter set in and their supplies ran out. But between where they stood in Siberia stood hundreds of miles of ice packs and floes and hundreds of miles of ocean beyond that. Their journey to the North Pole was now finished. Now they were racing to save their lives. And having traversed the Arctic ice pack for weeks, they had moments of luck on the ice pack when game happened to pass by their way. They gained themselves a few more days of food, but after hundreds of miles on foot, the last of their dogs had been killed, skinned, meat as food, their water rations precariously low. They needed to get to the North Sea and beyond that to Siberia and fast, but negotiating with the ever-shifting ice pack while hauling three lifeboats, food, water, and equipment, that was no easy task. Each day demanded navigating boulders of ice and crevices and unstable flows. The demands were overwhelmingly wearisome while working on empty stomachs, and the men's heads, it ached from dehydration and more torturous because ice surrounded them, but its salty contents would only hasten their demise. Finally, on September 11th, 1881, the water of the sea became visible. DeLong and his crew had traveled over 500 miles of Arctic ice to reach the open water, over 1,000 miles if you count how many times they had to turn around and find a different route. 91 days on the ice. Now they faced the formidable opponent of the unpredictable northern seas. Sailing for Siberia, the crew would divide into three lifeboats that they tugged across the ice with them. But they had no oars. Without oars, they would be at the mercy of the wind and tides, which they hoped would bring them ashore into safety and rescue. Facing another 500 miles of sea, DeLong would captain one of the boats, Chief Engineer George Melville another, and Lieutenant Charles Chipp the third. As the three crews settled into their lifeboats, they vowed, let's stay as close together as possible, but each of them knew this was an impossible task. This was likely goodbye for a single crew that had shared over 2 years of hardships together. And the open sea was only a matter of time before they were separated. And so the crews wished each other Godspeed and farewell, hoping to meet each other on the shores of Siberia. But 2 days into their voyage, a gale flared up as the three boats drifted further and further apart. High winds and waves the size of small buildings tossed the boats about mercilessly. Melville's ship had sailed off into the distance and disappeared over the horizon. DeLong looked back at Chip's vessel only to see it capsize, sending the men into the freezing waters. DeLong was helpless to do anything. He couldn't direct his boat. There was no room for another man in his vessel, even if he could. And so DeLong watched as Chip and his men struggled in the open water. With the water sitting at just 30 degrees, he knew the men would only have minutes. The struggling men disappeared over the horizon, and Chip and his crew were never heard from again. By the time the storm settled, DeLong and his men were utterly alone. No idea where Melville was, but they presumed the sea had had its way with them as well. But on the morning of September 19th, 8 days since they launched, DeLong and his men landed on a sandbar 100 meters from the Siberian shore. They were starving, frostbitten, muscles atrophying from spending a week in a tiny raft. They stumbled to the beach and realized their fate had once again taken a turn for the worse. By DeLong's best calculations, they had landed in the soggy labyrinth of the Lena River Delta. Area is a confusing network of small rivers that freeze over in the winter and then flood in the spring and summer. Even worse, DeLong realized they were a good 100 miles away from any settlement that might prove to be their rescue. Again, they would have to move on foot to find salvation. Starving by now, the men could hardly move, let alone walk. Situation was dire. DeLong had some difficult decisions to make. He sent his two healthiest men ahead. Find, bring back help in whatever form you can. And he informed the others they would have to rid themselves of any additional weight so that they could travel faster. Any fragment of equipment, any piece of clothing that wasn't essential would be discarded so they could trek inland quicker. But DeLong faced an agonizing decision. His journals were weighing him down. It needed to be left behind. It was a painful decision. Those journals were the record of his voyage, record of 2+ years at sea and in the ice. They were the record of he and his men's courage and bravery, their hardships and sufferings. These journals could very well be his final record, the only hope of keeping the memory of him and his crew alive, and in the end, he just couldn't do it. Right there on the shores of Siberia, he made a decision. The journals, the memory of his life and voyage, would stay with him until he found rescue or died trying. Chief Engineer George Melville's eyes were fixed on something unusual in the distance. Like DeLong in his boat, he had also landed in the labyrinth of the Luna River Delta, but fortune seemed to be on his side, and he and his men soon stumbled on a hunting camp, and they were able to find food and medicine. They spent a week recovering, finding others to help. And as soon as he was strong enough, Melville and a search party immediately set out on foot to search for his captain, George DeLong, the rest of the crew. But his hopes were diminishing. He'd been scouring the Luna River Delta for weeks, but had come up empty. But there in the distance was something unusual, probably a mile in front of him. Something looked out of place. And for years, the outside world had been wondering about the fate of DeLong. They had held their breath for any news at all, but as the months and then the years passed, concern had only grown, and many had thought the crew long since deceased, but Melville would not give up on his captain. Frustrated and desperate as he was, he wouldn't give up. He knew if DeLong were alive, he and his men would be starving by now. He was fighting against the clock, and something about that object in the distance seemed different to Melville, though. He sensed he was close. He could feel it. Pushing through brush and snowdrifts, whatever the object was, it appeared as a signpost of sorts. Marker consisted of a teepee of sticks tied together in a teepee patch, and more telling, there was a hunting rifle hanging from its height. He wasn't sure what to make of it, but if it was a marker, what did it mean? He was confident he was close. The snow seemed to blanket everything, but Melville couldn't shake this powerful sense that DeLong had camped there recently, and he quickly ordered his men to conduct a thorough search of the area. For hours, he and his men dug beneath the snow, they canvassed the region until finally a clue. At first, their excavation revealed the wood and ashes from an old fire pit, but as the men continued to dig in the snow, the scene they uncovered was a grisly one. Around the fire pit lay 7 men, all dead and frozen to the ground, and Melville recognized each one of them. He had spent months and years with these men. At least half of DeLong's party could now be confirmed dead, and the clues around their frozen bodies spoke of a dreadful and horrible death. As he surveyed the bodies, he noted that all of the men's shoes were partially eaten. There was not a whole boot left on any of the men. Each shoe was covered in bite marks, resembled half-eaten sandwiches. Starving, the men had resorted to eating the leather of their shoes and clothing. Melville discovered another curiosity. The dress on the men's backs was burned and singed. Starving and freezing, clinging too close to the fire for warmth, the clothes on their backs had been burned in a desperate attempt to find heat. Melville felt defeated. He was losing hope of finding anyone alive, especially his captain, George DeLong. Melville covered the bodies of his 7 friends and anxiously wondered, where would the others be? They had to be close by, and if they were still alive, they must be just clinging to life themselves. He knew he had to move quickly, and so in desperation, Melville headed for the highest ground he could find. Needed to gather his bearings, needed to get a sense of the landscape, see if he might spot the men close by, see what direction they headed next. He began to ascend a small hill, 1,000 meters away from where the others lay, when he spotted in the snow what seemed to be an article of clothing. Further up, a pair of gloves laid half buried in the snow, and moving forward, he found the remains of an old campfire. Beside it were logs and kindling wood. There was a chunk of ice, surely meant to provide drinking water. He was close to discovering something, but where were they, he wondered. Melville looked around, and out of the corner of his eye, he spotted an object peeking up from the snow, a copper tea kettle. Taking a single step towards it, Melville paused abruptly. Between him and the kettle lay a human corpse, hand and arm barely visible in the snow. Melville desperately brushed away the layer of snow, only to discover his friend and captain, George DeLong. He lay there, frozen solid, his body locked in an awkward position. Clearing away more snow, Melville found the other men as well, all dead, all frozen. Melville hollered for the rest of the search party. He wanted them there as witnesses. He wanted them there to help him absorb the discovery, the pain, help him figure out what had happened. His search had been in vain, and for years the world had wondered about the fate. Years they had wondered, and after months of searching, Melville knew. He had hoped to find DeLong, and his men had survived, but his hope was now dashed. He was too late. George DeLong was dead. Melville crouched over the body, looking for clues, looking for answers. All the other men lay curled up in a fetal position. Still, there was something curious about the position of DeLong's body that seemed curious to Melville. It was almost in an unnatural position. Melville knelt close to DeLong's lifeless body, and a wave of sorrow rushed over him. He sat motionless and silent in the cold, filled with regret. He wished he could say goodbye to DeLong, his captain, the man who had led him into the quest of a lifetime. He wished he could thank him for 2 years of leadership and steadfast courage in the face of their hardships. Mostly, though, he wished he could tell DeLong he was sorry. Sorry he couldn't get to him sooner. Sorry he didn't find him in time. Restless with grief, Melville couldn't shake the feeling there was something curious about the scene. The position of DeLong's body seemed so awkward. DeLong was lying on his right side in a fetal position, just like the other men. His right hand tucked under his cheek, facing downhill, but his left arm extended behind him, frozen in time, pointing uphill. Melville gazed in the direction of DeLong's frozen arm when another discovery revealed itself to him. There behind DeLong, just a few more feet uphill, lay what seemed to be a small, leather-bound book, lightly covered in snow. Tattered and worn and water-stained, standing over it, Melville could tell the entries in this journal were legible. Behind the back of the dead and frozen DeLong lay his journal. Melville's heart pounded even harder within his chest as grief and curiosity and sorrow and dread slammed into each other. He was frightened of the story it might tell. He wasn't sure he could stomach the tales of hardship he might find in its passages, but he was also curious, desperate to understand what had happened. What had happened in those final days? Melville sighed, slowly picked up the journal. Hands trembling, he opened the book. Skipped to the very end, hoping to find a farewell message. But the last page offered very little besides a grim testimony to DeLong's torturous final days. October 9th, a massive bull elk wandered into camp, but none of us could steady our weapons enough to fire upon him. Dying of starvation, the men desperately needed food, but their weakened bodies would no longer allow them to hunt. The journal only grew bleaker from there. October 11th, all hands weak and feeble, chewing on the scraps of our deerskin clothing, God help us. October 12th, everyone getting weaker and weaker, hardly strength to get firewood. October 13th, 123 days since we left the Jeannette. We cannot move against the wind, and staying here means starvation. We are in the hands of God, and unless he intervenes, we are lost. October 15th, a horrible night. We boiled 2 old boots for breakfast. We are broken down. October 19th, we are done up. Out of the depths have I cried unto thee, O Lord. Let thine ears be attentive to the voice of my supplications. My soul waiteth for the Lord more than they that watch for the morning. Psalm 193.
October 21st. Another three of us have died, Lee, Knack, and Alexei. October 23rd, 133rd day since the Jeannette sinking. Everybody pretty weak, slept and rested all day. Managed to get enough wood in before dark, suffering on our feet, no foot gear. After that, the journal dropped off into a stark recital of days past and deaths noted. The journal read as though DeLong were a prisoner on a deserted island trying to conserve his energy, only finding the strength to write the barest of facts. October 24th, 134th day, a hard night. 25th, 135th day. 26th, 136th day. October 27th, 137th day, Iverson breaking down. October 28th, 138th day, Iverson died during the early morning. October 29th, 139th day, Dressler died during the night. October 30th, 104th day, Boyd and Gortz died during the night, Mr. Collins dying. And that was it. His journal ended there. Melville snapped the book shut out of irritation and stared out over the bleak landscape. It didn't make sense. The dead men listed in the journal were over a kilometer away. Why were DeLong and his two men up on this hill so far from their comrades? Why had they made their way up there so high on the hill, exposed to wind and the elements? What had transpired that separated the two parties? Why was DeLong's body in this contorted position as if frozen in a struggle? Melville started flipping through the journal more frantically, looking for something, anything. He scoured the pages until a pattern began to emerge. DeLong notes several times in his journal that he was anxious about their location, Lena River Delta. It's notorious for being a frozen wasteland, but every spring the entire region floods in a thaw. During the early summer each year, what lay around them would end up submerged underwater for several weeks. DeLong noted in his journal that he was worried about any trace of him and his men disappearing forever underwater if they were not found before the thaw. Melville shut the journal again and began to discern the logic, and suddenly it all became clear to him. The crew had camped next to a river as a close, reliable source of drinking water, but DeLong knew come spring, everything, their camp, their bodies, all of their possessions, their journals, they would be washed away forever. No trace of them would ever be found. DeLong had to get to higher ground. After writing his final journal entry, DeLong and his two surviving crew members left their camp and dead colleagues. They clawed their way through a kilometer of snow to get as far uphill as they could. And here the floodwaters would be less likely to steal them and any record of their journey away. And when the men were spent and could climb absolutely no further, they tried to make a primitive fire, and then they had laid down to die. Melville was unsure whether it was hours later or days later, but DeLong would make his final gesture with his life slipping away. Removing his mitts, he clasped his journal in his left hand one last time, and then, as his dying act, he pitched it uphill. Just a few more feet uphill. Just a little higher. Completely spent, DeLong did not even possess the energy to bring his arm back to his side. So he died. Right there at that moment, frozen with his arm behind his back, pointing to his journal, which lay a few feet uphill. It was his final dying act, when he knew his life was lost, when he knew he couldn't save himself. His dying act was to save his story. Finished reading Kingdom of Ice at 2 a.m., tells you the story I just told you. Much more detail, but I'm sitting in bed reading and I finish. And lying in bed, I started crying. I get emotionally involved in stories, so that's not particularly uncommon for me, but I began to cry when I learned of DeLong's final act with his journal. Because I realized lying in bed that night that DeLong's story is also my own story. It's many of our stories. No, we haven't sailed north. Spent years in hardship facing ice and starvation. Not that part. I wouldn't last under a day under those conditions. Instead, it's the journal part of his story and his final act. See, in many ways, I feel like DeLong's last act is often my own. I spend so much time in life trying to get my story just a little higher. I spend so much of my time trying to get my story just outside the reach of the waters and tides of time. I want my story to be safe and remembered. I just want to be remembered. If I can just get my story just a little higher. Maybe you recognize some of yourself in DeLong's story. Perhaps, like DeLong, you're scared to leave your own story, your journal, your legacy behind to chance and time. Maybe, like DeLong, like me, your energy is spent trying to get your story, your legacy, just a bit higher so it's not washed away with time. Recall one summer up at the cottage, Kristen's family cottage, there on the beach, I built the sandcastle with Zoe. I spent the afternoon crafting the sandcastle, towers and turrets. There was walls and a moat. It was decent. By the time we retired that day, we were both quite proud of the work we had done with the sandcastle. But the next morning, back at the beach, my 4-year-old daughter Zoe at the time was devastated to find that her sandcastle was completely gone, washed away by the tides. And that morning, looking at where her sandcastle had been, she started crying, asking me, "Why? Why would this happen?" Endless questions. "Why does the water break our sandcastle, Dad?" I said, "I don't know, bud. Maybe, you know, tides and stuff, I guess. I don't know the specifics. Why do tides come?" "I don't know, honey. I think the moon makes the water come and stuff, something like that." "Why does the moon do that?" "Well, I don't know. I don't know why. But why, Dad? But why?" "But I don't know. Because the moon is mean. The moon is cruel, okay? Life's just cruel sometimes." Life is cruel. The waters of time come and wash away everything. Every memory of us. All that we build, all that we fashion, all that we make, it's eventually washed away. And this was George's fear, his palpable fear that his story, all he had been through, all his sufferings, be washed away with time. And it's a human truth that every castle we build, every memory, every mark and signature of our lives completely vanishes. I mean, many of us here this morning have probably never heard of George DeLong until now. George DeLong's story has lasted 140 years. That's not bad. Though I gotta tell you, his story is far more incredible than mine. So let me ask you this. How long do you think your story will last? How long do you think your story will survive after you're gone? Because when we die, sure, each of us will be missed for a while by those who loved us. But after that, how long until our story is completely forgotten? Is your story significant enough to last 140 years? Let me get just real bleak for a few seconds. Don't worry, we're coming out. But how long will it be before all the pictures of you are taken from their frames and all the pictures of you on phones disappear completely? How long before memories of us fade completely to black? How long before our legacies fade and disappear with time? How long after we go will it be before no one speaks of us or our name again? How long before your sandcastle is completely washed away? Think yet it'll make 140 years? 150? 200? Before you're completely gone, not even a memory. 150 years if we're lucky. All that effort in our one small, beautiful life that we put into building our castles and legacies, all the energy we expend trying to make our lives something worth remembering, gone, washed away. Have a good morning. Go in peace. No. This isn't pressing. Let's keep walking because this is the final week of the Jesus Path series. There's one more stop. We're on the home stretch. I want to show you one final thing about the Jesus Path of resurrection. You see, there's a story in Scripture that I've always loved. It's the story of the thief on the cross. And the Gospel of Luke is the only one that plays the scene out in its entirety. Jesus is being led out to his crucifixion. This is where we pick up the story. Two other men, both criminals, were also led out with him to be executed. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they divided up his clothes by casting lots, and the people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he is God's Messiah, the chosen one." The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, "If you're king of the Jews, save yourself." And there was a written notice above him, which read, "This is the king of the Jews." And one of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God?" he said. "Since you are under the same sentence, we are punished justly for getting what our deeds deserve, but this man has done nothing wrong." And then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus answered him, "Truly, I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." The scene is powerful to me. The mockery again that Jesus endures, it essentially again amounts to from the crowd, "Jesus, look at you, your story, your way, your path is nothing. It leads nowhere but death. You can preach and teach about grace and love and forgiveness all you want, but at the end of the day, Jesus, you just die like the rest of us. Your sandcastle, Jesus, will be lost to time. You, like the rest of us, will die and be forgotten as a big, pathetic nobody. Because your story and path, Jesus, ultimately loses to the story of death. It's powerless compared to death. Your path, Jesus, is ultimately just another dead end. A criminal also being crucified, he decides to jump in on the mockery, right? Until the criminal opposite him chimes in. "Jesus, remember me when you finally become king." There's those words again, "remember me." There are words, aren't they? Human words. "Remember me." This is our longing. Remember. Those two words, I think, are at the very core of our desires as humans. Just remember me. That's what I'm asking of life, is that something of me would be remembered. And there's almost a bit of a Monty Python comedy about this scene, right? It almost strikes me as a little bit absurd. "Hey, dying guy beside me, would you remember me? Hey, I got about 40 minutes left. I'd be happy to keep you in mind for the next 30 minutes. Like, it's absurd. Luke intends for it to be absurd. This thief on his deathbed is looking to be remembered, and he thinks his best chance of that is with a guy dying beside him. Not a very clever plan. And yet that is precisely the point. He is trusting his story to love crucified, to Jesus dying on a cross. And I love the fact that the thief remains nameless. We're not given his name. We don't even know his name, and yet we come to realize this. His time is up. His life is about to slip away. He's about to be forgotten forever to history. Story washed away by the waters of time. And here, about to die, he finally gets it. His story may not last, but there is one story that will last. And there's one story that moves into eternity. There's one story that will always remain. There's one story that is immune to the power of death and the passage of time, and it's the story of Jesus and his plan and path for the world. It's the story of love. In the end, only love remains. And in this story, no person and no soul is forgotten or left behind. If I want to be remembered and hope for any legacy, the thief realizes here, then forget my story and getting it a little bit higher. Forget trying to get me and my family and my success just a little higher up the hill we call a legacy. Because even some of the best stories only last a couple hundred years. What we need instead is to connect our story with the story of Christ and with the story of love. I need to connect and turn to the one who is the author of the future. His name is Jesus. And Jesus answers him, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." It's an astounding response. You will be remembered. Not just remembered, you're going to be with me. The thief's story is now part of Jesus' grander story. And if I want to be remembered, if I want to last, if we're going to last, we have to connect ourselves to the only story that lasts, Jesus' story and path of love and redemption. Jesus picks up on this, right, in the Gospel of Matthew. He's just delivered his Sermon on the Mount, greatest sermon that he's given, laid out his path and way for life, and he ends this way. It exposes how the Jesus pathway and path for living is summed up. "Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain and waters came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash." What is Jesus saying here? There's only one way of living that lasts into the future. There's only one story that remains into eternity. It's his story, his path. And those who ignore it and refuse to walk it are like those who built their sandcastles. Because when the rain and streams and waters rise, it'll be gone, forgotten, meaningless. But when you live in line with Jesus' way and story and path in the world, nothing can touch it. Because his story lasts into eternity. This is the incredible good news of Jesus' path of resurrection. Because if Jesus had just died, the whole thing would have been meaningless. But what the Jesus path of resurrection promises us is this: you can cut down love, you can destroy it, you can kill it, you can try to get rid of it, but God will raise it up, because love is the only story that lasts. And at Easter Sunday, God makes a verdict. And the judgment is this: in the end, love conquers death. And in the end, the only thing that will be found is love. And the invitation now to us is this: what story do you want to live by? Which path do you want to travel? It's pointless if our lives are about getting our stories just a little bit higher, doing what we can to keep them from being washed away. There's no hope. Doesn't matter how enormous your sandcastle is, no one cares. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter how big, great, or memorable your story is. In the end, death's waters will swallow all of it. But the promise of Jesus' resurrection is this: there's one story that lasts forever. The story of Jesus, his way, his path. So what story do we want to live by? Death, Paul says, has been swallowed up in victory. The Apostle Paul, overwhelmed with the thought of resurrection, he cries out, "Death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting?" The sting of death is sin. And the power of sin is the law, but thanks be to God, he gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my dear brothers and sisters, stand firm, let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. Life is not meaningless. Life is filled with it. But it all depends on which story we're living. Build your own story, your brand, your sandcast, and it'll be gone, forgotten, washed away. But a bigger story is playing out all around us, and you and I, we get to contribute a verse. Contribute to the story that lasts forever. And every time we do, Paul says, know this, our work is not in vain. N.T. Wright says, our work will somehow mysteriously make its way into eternity and will only be enhanced there. Our task, our way of life, as Jesus' path peoples, to build for the story of love. And so every act of love, every act of gratitude, every act of kindness somehow makes its way into eternity. Every work of art, Every music inspired by God makes its way into eternity. Every act of care and nurture and comfort and support for another human being, all of it makes its way into eternity in the story of love. Every gesture we do that cares for our earth makes its way into God's future. Every prayer, every deed that spreads God's message of hope, every selfless act, every action that rejects corruption and hate and cruelty and envy, all of it makes its way into eternity. Every unnoticed selfless act for others, for the marginalized, for the overlooked, it finds its way into eternity. And every time we put aside our story for the story of others, neighbors, community, for the world that makes its way into eternity, every word and deed we perform that declares Jesus is the future king, his story is the only one that lasts, all these things will make their way into the new creation that God will one day make. None of these things are wasted. They're not meaningless because there's a story that will last forever, and we get to contribute a line. And we will not be forgotten and will not be left behind. So that ends our tour of the Jesus Path that we started in November. We've got other places to go until summer, but at the end of the tour of the Jesus Path, one question remains. Can you trust this? I don't know. Sometimes I just want to push my story a little higher, buy myself an extra 10 years maybe. Can we trust this? Are we willing to trust Jesus' story, follow his path? In the resurrection we find hope and courage to trust that death does not have the final word and that we're not lost forever to time and decay. Can you trust this? And if you can you make it your way of life, the path you commit and follow to? Friends, thanks for coming along on the journey. I'm sure we're going to be traveling the path together for some time, but it's been a pleasure introducing you to the path I call compelling. For now, let's keep walking.